Hello, friends. It's me, Duncan, and this is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And today we have a wonderful guest, Tejo Munich. She was my very first meditation teacher when I was a student at Warren Wilson College in Asheville, North Carolina. I took classes in Buddhism with her, and I interned at her temple, which basically meant I cleaned the temple and I did a lot of meditation. She's a wonderful meditation teacher. And something I love about her and I love about Zen is that it focuses on the very simple, basic aspects of meditation practice. I'm somebody who likes to start at the end of things. When I first tried to learn piano, I didn't want to do the scales. I wanted to immediately be a high-level ragtime pianist. That never happened, and is never going to happen probably for me, because ragtime is really hard to play. But the only time I really started making progress when I was trying to teach myself piano is when I focused on the scales, the very basics, the very simple, boring, seemingly mundane basics of piano, where my hands go on the keys, how I'm supposed to sit on the piano bench, and just practicing the scales over and over and over. And the more I've done that, the better I've gotten at piano, though I still can't play ragtime. Similarly, when it comes to my sloppy, lackadaisical meditation practice, the less that I've focused on the possibilities that we all know about when it comes to meditation, enlightenment, launching your soul out of the back of a slit in your head, astral projection, telepathy, walking through walls, creating a kind of glowing aura of love around you that entrances and excites everyone, getting really good at sports because through meditation, you've learned how to pull yourself into the present moment. All of that stuff, the less I think about that stuff, and the more I work on my posture and a consistency when it comes to my meditation and my whatever books I might be reading about Buddhism or whatever spiritual path I'm interested in, to the less that other stuff seems to matter. And you realize baked in to the basics is the entire thing, from the least complex to the most mystical. So this is a conversation about that. One of her students asked a really wonderful question that led to this back and forth about the basics, the Buddhist precepts, the posture. And so I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. Plus, there's one of the funniest spiritual jokes I've ever heard in it that involves a fox. I won't ruin it for you. So stay tuned. Tejo Munich is here with us. First, the usual. I am headed back out on the road after a couple of weeks break. You can see me live at the Spokane Comedy Club in Spokane, Washington. That's the 2nd of November to the 4th of November. I'm also going to be in Salt Lake City the 17th of November to the 18th of November. After that, my last date of the year is going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina at the Comedy Zone. Won't you come? I hope to see you out there. Also, subscribe to the Patreon. You'll get commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, access to a thriving, beautiful, powerful, erotic, romantic, intellectual, philosophical society of geniuses. I ran out of adjectives, all right? It's patreon.com/DTFH. Won't you sign up? And now, everybody, welcome back to the DTFH Tejo Munich. All the links you need to find Tejo and connect with the Great Tree Temple in Asheville, North Carolina, will be at duncantrussell.com. Welcome, Tejo Munich.
Welcome, welcome all of you, that you are with us. Shake it. morning and welcome to Great Tree Zen Women's Temple. This morning we have two speakers in conversation. But before we introduce the speakers, I would like to read a Dhamma statement. In Buddhism, when Zen practitioners share their understanding of the teachings and practice, it is offered freely as the practice of Dana Paramita. Dana is a Pali word that means generosity or to give freely, and this practice is done without expectation of getting something in return. This is the spirit of speaking about the Dharma. Other ways to practice Dana is to offer support to those who share the teachings, to support places of spiritual practice, and to aid without judgment or expectation when opportunities arise. Those who share the teachings at Great Tree do so on a Dana basis. Please support their practice by giving what you can. And Duncan, do you have a place that you would like Dana to go to for you?
Oh, no, Great Tree Temple.
Then you can go to greattreetemple.org and follow the donate path. Our two friends who are in communication and conversation today are Duncan Trussell. Duncan Trussell is a comedian and a host of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast and the co-creator of the Midnight Gospel. And the Reverend Tejo Muni is founder and abbess of Great Tree Zen Women's Temple and disciple and Dharma heir of Danyan Katagiri Roshi. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to just do one more thing. Okay. I think we're rich.
Great.
So I want to start by asking Lorna to ask the question that she asked me to ask you.
Cool.
We've been studying in our practice period a book by Frank Anderson called Being Upright, and it deals with the precepts. And I know you come from a different Buddhist background, and I was wondering about your thoughts on the precepts.
My fantasy regarding the precepts is that they spontaneously would happen. I mean, this is a fantasy, you know, spontaneously you would just sort of be so in the moment and in the fourth moment, which is something I'm just learning about now. My teacher's teaching me about that whatever emerged would fall within the precepts. But that in the meantime, I think of them as a sort of outside in situation. So because I am not in, I don't have any kind of stabilized experience of emptiness. It comes and goes. And in those moments, I do think that there is some kind of spontaneous adherence, or I wouldn't even call it adherence, a natural sort of way of being in the world. And you could see from that natural way of being how these precepts would appear in some written form. So I think when it's a great thing when you're not there to have that to lean into. And also that I've noticed that when I'm doing things outside of the precepts, which I hardly ever do, I noticed that it tends to create instability, chaos, and creates sort of obstacles in between me and the next time I find myself in that place. So I think they're also sort of a way, like swimming lessons in a way, so as not to create so many ripples. Create a lot of ripples when you're outside of those things. I guess that's my answer.
And do you have anything else to follow up on?
I guess the only other thing that I was curious about was how Tibetan Buddhism handles the precepts and teaching the precepts?
I think that it is a non-expert in Tibetan Buddhism, and I have a really wonderful teacher. And when we work together, he says, we do this in real time, meaning that even though I would like to get some advanced transmission or a, I don't know, magical powers or something, unfortunately, he works with me where I'm at is still in this basing, working on posture, you know, that stuff, you know, and I've been there for years. So I guess that's, so just so you know, I'm no expert on Vajrayana Buddhism at all. And but if I had to, just from my layman sort of thinking about it, I think that within this form of Buddhism, there is a teaching regarding holding both sides of things simultaneously, you know, so that on one level you could say everything perfect, all karmic activity has within it an awakening quality. And if you wanted to break every single precept and go just hog wild, you could hear that and think, great, this means I can go doing anything I want all the time and then tell myself, this is my practice. And I, you know, I actually asked, this isn't an answer about the Tibetan version of it. I asked, Roshi Jonah, or no, Sharon Salzberg about this. I think it was Sharon Salzberg, because I'd been really leaning into this idea of like, you know, it's all Dharma, it's all teaching. So this is when Westworld was out, and I would like, because it's a cowboy robot sci-fi, I would get whiskey, drink whiskey and watch Westworld, fantasizing that I was some kind of robotic cowboy. And I asked Sharon Salzberg, this is a practice, right? I mean, I'm sitting, I'm like in the moment watching the thing. And I think her response was, it's a practice, but you're practicing the wrong thing, which I found to be a wonderful answer. And I needed that, you know, I'm not at the place where I think that I am skillful enough to do anything I want to. That just doesn't work out for me. So I need some kind of orange cones up around me right now. But I would think that if you were advanced enough, then theoretically, anything, any activity, anything that you were doing wouldn't have some sort of boundary around it, or this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, but would be all part of just this moment or experience. Again, that's theoretical. That's theoretical. I've tried. I could tell you this. I've tried really hard to do the tantric thing and really like trick myself into thinking that smoking cigarettes and getting hammered was some sort of spiritual attribute. And just doesn't really seem to lead me to a good place over time. It just doesn't. I wanted to. Oh, gosh, I would love that. But unfortunately, it doesn't. It just seems to me just like, what is it? Hold on one second. I have this on my piano.
What the?
This is Pema Chodron's Lojong cards. And this one, I think, is the one that I dislike and need the most, which is first train in the preliminaries. First train in the preliminaries. That's where I got to stay. Because this other stuff is really high concept, lifetimes of practice stuff. And it's so, if you could see how like my karma is to not first train in the preliminaries, my orientation is to go to the very furthest reaches I could find and then work backwards. That's how I'd answer that one.
Thank you. I was thinking as you started talking that pretty much that's the way Dogen Zenji talks about it too, that he says that it reaches a way end to impermanence and interdependence. We can't break the precepts. And really, I think that's what happens to us when we're sitting up, pushing again and again and again. Never goes out that again and coming back. Yeah. Just those moments, like you say. And then the book that we're reading Being Upright by Rami Anderson right now. And he seems, and he, what he's doing is he's talking about, he's making commentary on Dogen's commentary on the precepts, or on a precept on the Dogen commentary. And what I keep noticing, and other people who are reading this, and then people really might want to comment on this too, is that it keeps going back to the real breaking of the precepts is being self-centered.
Yeah.
In other words, not taking that our relationship with other forms of reality into, you know, not recognizing that. Yeah. And that recognition is not an intellectual recognition. That's the problem. It's intellectual kind of in retrospect.
Right. Yeah.
And so when it's happening, we, you know, until we become familiar with that experience, then we don't have the awareness that when it's, you know, that not judging that. I think we judge that experience that we have and oneness or emptiness. We judge it as not real because it's not familiar. And when it becomes more familiar, when we've done more meditation, then we start to just accept it as reality.
Yes, yes, yeah. And I think that what's interesting when people hear things like precepts or, I don't know, commandments or any kind of rules set around spirituality, there's a habitual like cringe that happens, right? Where you interpret that as a place where a lot of shame or guilt or self-pruning can happen. Whereas I think that what you're talking about, the sort of ground of where these precepts come from, is as wild as wild can be. It's a completely undomesticated, untamed, unbridled ground. I was laughing with my wife because we realized that our baby, our new baby, is wild. Like, this is as wild as you can be as a human. Like, you know, not capable of like movement. You can't control arms, legs, but this baby is outside of any kind of precepts, any kind of do this, do that, good, bad, purely in the moment and purely wild. There isn't the baby isn't questioning herself. When she wants milk, she wants milk. When she's crying, she's unhappy. When she's laughing, something is funny to her. And it reminds me of this Loudon Wainwright song, Be Careful, There's a Baby in the House. And the line goes, be careful, there's a baby in the house, and a baby is better than smart. And so this is what you're talking about outside the intellect, better than smart. We're talking about something that the intellect is within. So I think maybe that's what they're getting at with this sort of, you know, for me, theoretical spot or zone where the precepts become a spontaneous quality of life versus an initial imposition. And I see how it brings me to a question I wanted to ask you, but how in my first earliest days of practice with you, you were my first Dharma teacher, Teja, how it is purely intellectual, because you're reading this stuff. You hear you, you know, you're taking a class with you. You're studying it. You're reading these things, and your mind is creating an approximation of, oh, this must be emptiness, or this must be what they're saying here. This must be what that is. And if you have more than an academic interest and you want to start practicing because you have this sense of like, I'm not sure that I'm really touching anything here other than simulating something mentally. And then you get these little glimpses when you start applying some of these, hopefully all the precepts to your practice or just having a practice. And then it does, but then it all starts making sense. But in retrospect, you know, that is so frustrating, by the way, the retrospect part.
So is it under question?
Oh, my question for you is, can you, sorry, I forgot the question part. Your initial, when you first started practicing versus now, can you talk about maybe some intellectual ideas you had regarding Dharma, Dharma practice, and any of those that changed over time? Some preconceived notions regarding Buddhism that have shifted over the course of your practice.
Well, I could say that I didn't exactly know that it was Buddhist when I started with my teacher. I was just kind of drawn to his energy. So I didn't exactly have any preconceived ideas about Buddhism. I wasn't that interested in Buddhism actually. But one thing I do remember that a very clear thought was that if I just learned all the forms, that I wouldn't have to do anything else.
Big.
And what I discovered at a certain point was that I was very attached to the forms and to the detail of the forms, to the point where if someone did something that wasn't correct, my body would just react.
Wow.
You know, and you know, so that kind of, and then that recognition of how I was attaching to the forms also made me realize how I, you know, I was a way of kind of distancing myself from the work that we have to do internally, just to kind of say, well, the forms will do all the work, you know, follow the form. And to some extent, I think that's true. You know, because in dance, that's certainly true. But there's also kind of a spirit behind it that, you can't just rely on the forms.
Right.
And maybe that's, you know, when you said earlier you have to hold both sides or something like that. He said, I want to see what both sides does he mean. And I figured later I started thinking, oh, he probably meant things that were pleasant or unpleasant. I don't know exactly what you meant, but my meaning was reaction was relative and absolute.
That's what I was trying to get at, relative and absolute reality, that sort of in an absolute reality situation, no precepts. Relative reality, precepts. You know, somewhere in there we need if I'm everything, I don't know where the precepts come in. I mean, I don't even know I don't know what it would be like to be everything. Absolute reality. But if I'm like deep in relative reality and I'm sitting in the steam room at my gym and someone's yapping, I'm sorry if this is completely unrelatable, but I really don't like it when people talk in the steam room. There's no rule, but I don't like it. And so if someone's in there yapping about like their latest real estate deal and I'm just trying to not pass out, there's a part of me that gets so embarrassingly irritate, you know, so, and you feel like you just feel yourself right on the precipice of making a horrible mistake, because really you're going to silence somebody who can bench press 400 pounds in the steam room. How's that going to go for you? You know, when you feel that moment, be like, just stop. This is a quiet place. It's so relative reality. I need these precepts. I need some kind of map. I'm not naturally a generous selfless kind of person. That just doesn't come naturally to me. Compassion does not come naturally to me. None of this stuff comes naturally to me. So I need just basic, like, simple something to refer to in those moments. You know, that's relative reality. That's what I meant. So maybe in to go back to that earlier question, maybe there is this possibility of holding both of those spaces simultaneously or something. I don't know. But I usually pendulum between the two.
Well, you know, as I was talking about the forms, I was thinking at the same time, you know, that they are totally useless. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like with a dance, for everybody to move together, having a form. And then movement together, we just experienced that. I'm pointing to Trey. I don't know if you can, Gilmjo, I don't know if you can, you can't see him. See, there's his ass. He was out in the LA footprint, and we experienced this 5-day ritual of precepts ceremony, renewal and receiving. There were 180 people in the space doing it together. And, you know, we all had our stuff that we were supposed to do at specific times. You know, you talk about forms and everybody was like wanting to do it right and everything. But at the end, a product was that we were all moving together. And that experience of interdependence, even in just around, and it wasn't just being, it wasn't just human beings. It was like all beings in the room, you know, sort of like we invited beings that we, that we didn't even know existed. And probably beyond the temple, you know. Of course, we brought it back to Asheville, and I still feel that connection. But, you know, to have those forms really can bring us to, can move us to another place. These rituals can actually lift us up and can take us to a different space so that our mind becomes clear for a moment.
Yes.
The first time that I did this particular 5-day on Jukai, it's called a precept ceremony, that one of the speakers said to us, well, now you have, what part of the ceremony is repentance, you're letting go of the stuff we really don't want to do. And setting aside, you know. And he said, so now you've repented, so you're clear of all your bad life karma. But he says, probably you're going to go outside and immediately.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, no, I'm going to really pay attention and not. And sure enough, I mean, it wasn't 5 minutes I was outside and I found myself.
Yeah.
You know, so it happens very quickly. But at the same time, my awareness was somewhat different. I was thinking, oh, yeah, I'm doing this now.
Yeah.
Which is different than being engaged in it, thinking about it afterwards, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that.
Right. I mean, yeah, you can. I understand. You know, I think there are all these little mini heartbreaks in Buddhism. I don't know any other way to put it than these little mini heartbreaks, because you do. So here are these forms. You're working with these forms, hopefully a teacher. And it's, you go through this, these moments of like, you're there. This is it. It isn't intellectual. There it is. This is real. It's not just some academic nonsense or some archaic anything. There's a reason it's been around as long as it has. And it's such a joy, a legitimate joy. And of course you would connect that to the forms, because if you weren't doing these forms, if that does happen, it happens in, at least for me, in some random moment, and you don't even know why or what it is, and then you forget about it. And so the attachment to the forms for me becomes very sentimental. My attachment to you, I mean, I bet you don't even know how much I think about you. My first Dharma teacher, I think about you all the time. My attachment to David, my teacher, it's attachment. It's a loving attachment, but it's attachment. And then you remember, geez, they're I don't think they're immortal. Well, what happens when they're not here anymore? And then that's a bummer. And then But then my first introduction to the Heart Sutra was a Sashin we sit, and I was not ready for it. And there you are, you know, in that droning, chanting way, reading the Heart Sutra. And then within that seems built in a dissolution of the forms. And I don't even think I understood why it hit me so hard. But now, yes, I don't want to lose the form. I don't want to lose the structure. I don't want to let go of it. I'm barely understanding it at all right now. And the idea of like letting go of all of that is something about it when I'm up in my head is really heartbreaking. So I understand the attachment to these things and why someone could get incredibly attached to the forms for their entire practice, their entire life. I was meditating in the woods once. And I had this obvious realization. Buddhism doesn't own meditation. This has been around from before the word Buddhism existed. This is something outside of even Buddhism. And it was nice to realize that, but then also kind of weirdly disappointing. I want this is our zone. And then you realize this is everybody's zone. This is everyone's. And that, I don't know why. I mean, that hits me the wrong way, which is lame. I don't want to let go. Like suddenly you begin to let go of all the relative reality stuff in a healthy way. And then out of the blue, the next trick it's thrown at you is, yeah, but you're going to have to let go of Buddhism too, you know. No. What? I don't want to. I want something.
My little Dukkha.
What's that?
I said, you know, Dukkha.
Yeah.
I was thinking, well, Gore, when you said, you have that experience, you're just kind of there. And I don't remember exactly, you said it a little bit more clearly, but, you know, that experience of just being present with everything. And you'd say, oh my gosh, everything is just flowing and I'm in the zone, you know. But I remember something that Katagiri Roshi said that made me think about how, you know, by the time we notice that we're there, you know, we're already attaching to there and asking ourselves, oh, how did I get here? And what can I do to stay here?
Yep. That's it. And there you go. It's I watch my kid at swim class. He's learning to float on his back. It reminds me of that. Because like he will, in the beginning, he can now do it. But in the beginning is, you know, you got to calm him down. This is water, man. This is way bigger than the bathtub. And they don't know you can float if you're relaxed. And yeah, the moment he starts floating, he's like, I'm doing it. And then down you go into the water. You know, it's just like that. And then if you don't have some way, then once you're in the water again, you're just like, oh, then you could panic and you're not going back on your back again. You know, and every single early contact with what we're talking about here was milliseconds before, oh wow, this is it, I'm there, baby, I did it, this is what they were talking about. And then you're just, it's gone, just gone.
And I'm gonna write a book.
That's it. Oh no, our podcast, I'm gonna talk about this on the podcast.
Right.
I can't wait to yap about this one.
So when we were at a monastery one time, we slept in tents, you know, it was pretty primitive room thing. And he had a little one-room cabin. And in this little one-room cabin, he had a Japanese bathtub that somebody had bought for him. And we didn't even have running water. We had to heat the water down at the kitchen and take it up to his cabin. So in order to fill this thing, it was like a really big deal. But one day he was talking about how after, you know, because we had long days, we'd get out 4 o'clock in the morning and go to bed at like 9:30 or something and just go roll all day. And so he said somebody had prepared his bath for him and he went and he got into the bath, you know, and he looked out the window and there was the load and he thought, wow, this is perfect. And he said, I need to write a poem. And then he said, I need to write a poem, it's too much. He said, this is perfect. It's too much.
Yes.
I need to write a poem, result is too much. He said, this is perfect. It's too much.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, gosh, imagine if poems became sentient, you know, the greatest poems, I don't know, Paradise Lost or something, realized it was Paradise Lost. And then suddenly tried to start writing poems about being Paradise Lost that ruined the entire poem.
That don't you got a little too far out for me, Duncan.
I'm sorry. I mean, but you know, you just, I'm sorry. That's the problem. I just.
You're saying I didn't quite follow that.
Well, I mean, in that moment, you know, there is someone who's in the weave, you know, in the thing, and a perfect, beautiful, you described it so I can almost see it, you know, and then this instinct or impulse to like try to make it better. I'm going to improve it somehow, even if it is generosity, which I think in his mind, he's not thinking like, I'm going to write a poem so everyone says I'm a great poet. He's so inspired. I want to share this somehow.
Yeah. And I remember when he was talking about it, I was thinking, oh, good, he wrote a poem about it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that there is a way, you know, maybe there is a way to have those mind moments and still be there in the bathtub looking at the moon and not have the whole thing, you know, spiral off into some mental confabulation. Maybe there is a way. I think there would be a way where the thoughts become part of the scene itself when there isn't that disconnect. I think it would theoretically be a way. But for me, it's just like, no, it's like waking up, you know, it's like waking up in the wrong way or something, or going back to sleep. It's convoluted what I'm trying to say, but you wake up from a dream, you know, and go back to sleep.
Story about the poem by Show, a poem by Show. And Basho lived out, you know, out in the woods, I don't know, outside. And anyway, he used to, every day he used to go to a chair in a tree and eat cherries. He would just look forward to the cherry season. And one day he went there and there was a fox out in the tree. And he said to the fox, hey, what are you doing in my tree? That was my tree. And the fox said, well, what makes poor in you? He said, I'm Basho, I'm a great poet. And he said, so? And he said, anyway, he said, everyone knows that foxes are better poets than people. And so Basho said, really? And he said, yeah. And he said, in fact, I'll tell you what, if you can write a poem that is as good, that is accepted by us foxes, you can have all the cherries in that tree, and they'll all bother you anymore. And so he was like, I'll give you three chances. So Basho was, so my lady planned a time to meet, and Basho goes home and he's writing. And he finally had available just the perfect dog. And he goes and he meets the fox, and the fox hears the poem, and he was like, well, yeah, it's okay, but not that great. So Basho was very sad, and he went home and he worked on it again. Same thing. And he went back and the fox said, hey, yeah, better, but not that great. So then he goes home and he's writing, and he cannot come out. And it's time to meet the fox. It's like every month or something. And he goes to meet the fox. He's trying to think of a poem as he gets there. And just like the second before he meets the fox, he thinks of nothing and he says it. And I can't remember exactly something like the moon is full, the fox is waiting, and something. I don't remember exactly how it goes. And so the fox said, oh my gosh, that it's perfect. You are a great poet. You're a rare poet than any fox poet I've ever heard. So you can have a cherry tree. Well, my show said, well, we could share a tree, but I just want to know one thing. What was so great about this poem? And he said, well, it had a fox in it. And my show said, and then my show decided, then fox of words is great. Oh, I'm out here.
That's hilarious. I love that.
But you know, I mean, the thing that I love about that is just how, like, it points to just the moment. He was really in the moment, and he was really present, and he saw the fox. He saw the fox. That's all the fox wanted, was to be seen, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it reminds me, there's a story I heard about Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was with Allen Ginsberg. And Allen Ginsberg was marveling at the number of Dharma talks on Trungpa's schedule, like nonstop, just teaching, teaching, teaching. And Ginsberg was, how do you do this? You know, I have to do all these poetry readings and it's annoying and I just, it's too much. And Trungpa said to him, oh, well, you know, you don't like these poetry readings because you don't like your poems. And Ginsberg is like, what are you talking about my poem? What are you talking about my poems? And Rinpoche said, why don't you write your poems on stage? Don't you trust your mind? You know, and that's such a beautiful way of sort of pointing out the technical thing. I'm listening to this wonderful book on meditation right now called Why We Meditate. Highly recommend it. It's wonderful. Simple. For me, it's a simple thing, simple book, but it's really good. And yeah, they talk about near enemies and far enemies, right? And so that the near enemy is the one that you think is your friend, but is really getting in the way. And that is where you get too technical. In stand-up comedy, it's when you get too attached to your jokes. And you get on stage and you just do joke, 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 no spontaneity, not letting any, no risks, nothing. And then you'll have a very dry set. And maybe you won't make them laugh and maybe it will be a good show, but you'll get off stage and feel rotten. And then there's the moments where you're fully there and you realize you're not doing material anymore. All the jokes you've been spending months and months refining and getting funnier, they're out the window. But somehow you're doing better than you were doing with the jokes. This is the dream moment, you know, because it's hard to write and it's hard to revise. But when the thing starts happening, it's coming out of you. It's so beautiful and so exciting. And then inevitably you're like, the next show, you're like, forget my jokes. I'm just going to go out there with my brilliant mind. And you bomb because you're trying to fake do the thing that spontaneously happened. You're being fake spontaneous.
Attachment to spontaneity.
Attachment to spontaneity. It is so, so deadly and so easy to do. And what a path to laziness.
But you know, the thing I was thinking as you were speaking is that all those years of reviving and writing and figuring it out, all those things led to that moment when you're on stage and you're not trying to use any of it.
Yes.
It all kind of gets integrated. And so you can't really not pay attention to that either. Well, that can't be ignored.
No.
Both are needed. But it's so easy to attach one way or the other, you know, like you were talking, be attached to spontaneity and attached to material, you know.
Yep. It's true. It's just, this is the, you know, they talk about, in the Old Testament, God builds some kind of weird gate or something in front of the Garden of Eden. You can't get in there. There's paradise right there, but you just know there's no way to get in there. And it reminds me of that. It's like this beautiful gate, you know, it's this beautiful ornate sort of constructed thing that you've built to try to evolve or advance yourself or become enlightened or whatever. And you just get so attached to that beautiful gate that you just don't ever open it. You never go through it. You just sort of remember always adding more golden angels to it and weird little lightning bolts or whatever you put on your gate. But, you know, but you never go through.
Mm-hmm. We've got about 15 minutes left, and I was thinking maybe we might have some comments from others. Should we go in that direction?
Oh, let's try it. Let's see if the same thing happens last time. I'm terrified.
Oh, no. Yeah, I have a plan.
Okay, cool. Last time we got invaded.
Yep. Zoom bombed.
That's what it's called.
I know a real person now.
It was wild.
Does anybody have anything they want to mention or anything? I mean, Duncan and I could go on for days.
I can. Oh, my God. Barely got started here. This is what happens when you're doing.
Hi. Thank you. I've enjoyed your conversation a lot. I just want to go back to something Duncan said at the very beginning about just practicing your posture for years. You know, going back to the basics. And I immediately thought of the title of the book that we've been referencing, Being Upright, and how that shows up as a metaphor also for the practice of, like, literally when you're sitting and you're leaning forward too much, you're kind of grasping or clinging. Or if you're leaning back, there could be some aversion also. And that just sort of pendulum idea that you were talking about, and just that it's impossible to perfectly sit upright or be, you know, upright in the metaphorical sense, like do everything right all the time. So, you know, the impermanence of kind of, you know, moving back and forth, however subtly or drastically that you're doing it, it just noticing that. And in that moment, noticing where you are on the pendulum and making, you know, whatever correction you think you need to make at that time, you know, literally while you're sitting or, you know, out in the world trying to follow the precepts. So, that just occurred to me and wanted to kind of tie those things together.
That's so cool.
Thank you. You know, wow.
That is amazing. I love that. I never, you know, I've always thought when I'm slumping forward, I get sleepy. That's what I've noticed. But yeah, I get, oh yeah, when I'm slumping forward, that sleepiness, I guess, is an attempt to escape into my sleep. Like, get out of here. You know, that's I'm grasping. I get that. And then leaning back. Yeah, that's when you're getting too tight. There's some weird aggression in the, wow, that's so cool. I love that. I've never heard that before. It made me think of a question for you, Teja, real quick. It's interesting that there, what is the, in what's the part of ourself that knows how to adjust? You know, how do we know that? How do we know, like, the ideally, what is that part of yourself? What is that where you're making these micro adjustments? Where's that coming from?
I mean, it's coming from balance, from the need for looking for balance. Yeah, you know, and because one of the things that I noticed about posture is that's how we, if one thing is a little bit off, that everything gets off because we're trying to bring ourselves into balance.
Yeah.
And you could see it when you look around the road too. I face outward here and everybody else faces the wall, but I can see a lot in people's, the way that now people are dealing with their bodies. And in my own body too, you know, we'll do some Meredith Manikash 90 Alexander technique, or she teaches Alexander technique, which is a body awareness. I call it body Zen.
Yeah.
Because it's the awareness of noticing where we're holding. And when we notice where we're holding, then we can begin to undo it. We do retreats at Southern Dharma, and we call it the undoing of doing.
Wow.
And cool. Zen technique, I wrote the same. You know, and when you start to really notice those things in your body and undo those things in your body, you start to see the teachings in a more three-dimensional way.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just all in our head. It's our body lines.
Yeah.
And so in Soto Zen, Dogen Zenji's main emphasis, he doesn't talk about anything to do on the cushion. Just sit there, but, you know, your posture. Yeah. How are you? Notice how you're sitting. He gives as detailed as he gets about giving instructions. He gives instructions about how to sit upright, and that is where the emphasis of Soto Zen ends. I won't have to even think about, he said, just leave thinking alone.
All right.
Make him now thinking he's up.
Wow. Yeah, lately that is where my thinking mind is going, though, is posture-related questions. Like, it's gone from these, like, high-minded questions to just sort of like, is my head supposed to be facing, like, I have a Buddha statues everywhere and they're upright, but then I for the longest time I was like sort of looking down at an angle. That's not it, right? You're supposed to keep your head up, like your eyes would face forward, but they're sort of looking down. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm at a 45 degree angle. Zen, yeah,
this
some traditions keep their eyes closed.
I know. Yeah. I like the eye open thing, but yeah, it creeps into your, over time, these weird things creep into the posture. You know, that's, I think, why group meditation, like what you're doing, must be really good, because you don't even realize that you've started angling your head down, you know, that you've gotten in weird habits. It's so easy to do.
Well, a lot of these habits are things that we bring to our meditation practice. So we've already developed certain habits as we were growing up. Now, when I used to teach, movement at a Montessori elementary school. So I had everything from preschool all the way through junior high. And I noticed with the 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds that when they walk with their parents, you could see that they carry their bodies in the same way. The girls carry their bodies in the same way as their mothers, and the boys carry their bodies the same way as the fathers. So, you know, we pick up those habits at a very young age.
Yeah.
And carry them into our adulthood, and we don't even know we've got certain body habits.
Right.
I had to deal with a lot of my body habits in order to even be able to continue sitting, because I was putting my back out from the way I was holding my body.
Yeah. Right. I could see that. Yeah. You know, like with my lame meditation practice of 20 minutes or whatever, you know, I could get away with a lot. But if you're doing the kind of sitting that you Zen people are doing, my goodness, this, you can't really mess around. You have to have a good posture. You're going to throw your back out.
Yeah. You mess up your body. If people do it by forcing their bodies to do things rather than trying to figure out how to make the adjustment.
All right.
We did it for our bodies. You know, it's kind of not just a cultural thing here. I mean, I think it's worse in Japan.
Really?
But anyway, Anne, did you have something you were going to ask or say?
Yeah, I have a question, but I just want to say, before I ask my question, that I've had the experience of doing those retreats with Tejo and Meredith. And before doing that in my life, I've never done a long sesshin without coming out feeling really wrecked, you know, physically. And when Meredith was there, noticing people the whole time and helping them undo the bad posture that was going to give them problems, I came through the 5 or 6 days and I felt fine. It was a real awakening. So, but my question was just a simple one. You mentioned something about the fourth moment.
Yeah.
I never heard of that. So can you talk about what that is?
Okay, I'll try. And again, I'm not going to keep doing this, like, beating myself up here, but I just feel ethically, I have to say, I misunderstand a lot of these things. And then I'm yappy, and I feel like I speak with some confidence that makes it seem like I know what I'm talking about. So please look into it. David was telling me about something Trump was talking about, which is sort of these three moments. And I don't know if this is something Trump came up with or if this has its roots in Tibetan Buddhism, but first moment, past. Second moment, future. Third moment, present. And so most people are hanging out, you know, first moment, second moment. You're thinking about something, you're up in your head, daydreaming about the past, or you're thinking about something that's around the corner and getting all anxious over that. And then, you know, when you first start practicing, you start learning about this third moment, the present moment. This is Ram Dass, be here now. It's almost a cult these days, you know, like be in the moment, just be in the now. But then if you've been hanging out in either the first moment or the second moment for most of your life and you do find the present moment, it's the best. Wow. You know, of course your anxiety is going to go down. Your heart rate's going to go down because you're not freaking out over something that happened that you can't do anything about, or something that you think is coming that probably isn't. And so there's this relief. That's what Trump starts talking about, is this where you start thinking that the third moment, well, that's it. I'm here. I've arrived. This is what it is, just right here in this moment. And he talks about this can be a kind of sand trap. The present moment can be a sand trap. I think the description was like, it's so colorful. It's so bright. It's just this, you know, vivid. But then the fourth moment is something that I think the present moment is hanging out in. And the fourth moment is just pure awareness. You're not in the present moment, the first or the third. And because I think the present moment, you get attached to that. That's another thing. You get super attached to it. You know, I even read, I don't know if this is true, Tejo, maybe you know if this is true, it's some monastery, there was a rule about going into samadhi, like, because the monks were getting addicted to that, this nirvanic state that I think it must be related to the present moment. They were figured out how to, like, have these extreme bliss moments, and they were like, no, like, don't do you, you're, that's another trap. There's another place that is not present moment, first, second, third moment related. You know, Jack Kornfield, I heard him say, in Buddhism, God is lists. There's so many lists, man. But that's how I understand it. It's something that isn't tethered to any of those first three moments. And so there's something liberating about it.
Thanks for asking that, Ab. I still don't know what it is, but I think so. Thinking about.
Yeah, I never heard. You know, I that's the first I'd heard of this. Maybe there's a fifth moment we don't know about. Maybe one of us will discover it.
One of the things I was thinking was, may in indulgent sense, you know, Logan wrote something called Being Time, and in that sense, the first, second, and third moments would all be the same.
Yeah, right. Because they have to be.
And that, we not understand by the word moment of that. There is no first, second, or third moment. It's all the same. It's all being done.
I think that is a much better answer than the one I gave. Thank you.
I don't know. Anyway, we're at the hour, and thank you, Duncan. Let's do it.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone at Great Tree Temple. Thanks for the DTFH folks that are here. I just love these so much, Tejo. Thank you so much. I can't believe I get to have personal, like, conversation with you like this. I feel so lucky and grateful. And thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you. You're the most famous person I know personally.
You got to get that spell.
Well, I ask you back, Marin. Main Marin of this practice.
Main
of this practice. That all beings. Benefit all beings and bring peace. One, thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everybody. Have a great day.
You too.
That was Tejo Munich. Again, it's Great Tree Women's Temple in Asheville, North Carolina. I hope you'll check them out. They have weekly Zoom meditations if you're interested and lots of other stuff. Big thank you to our sponsors, and thank you for listening. I love you guys, and I'll see you next week.